It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. What a couple of days it's been. I point to Florida. We've got some real problems on the horizon, and it starts with our political system. You know, as I've been saying, elections have consequences. And the folks in Florida, you are suffering because of it. And I look at your governor, Ron DeSantis, out railing against Joe Biden's vaccine mandate. Actually was in Gainesville, Florida, giving city workers the ability to come out and complain about, how dare you make me protect myself, Joe Biden. And then, of course, spreading, misinformation, lies, and just total BS. At one point, he let some guy get up and say, the vaccine changes your RNA. And, it's a popular, I've heard T-Twizzlers and the Trumpkins say that before. There's literally no proof to it. But I always get the, can you prove that it does it? Yes, they can. That's the thing that's really dangerous about this. And you've got DeSantis, who was quite happy to allow these myths and to use these myths, to use these lies to further his end. Because look, we're in a moment right now where the mask issue, the vaccine issue, it's visceral. If you're against it, you think the end of the world. It's the end of the world. How dare you? And people are staking their political fortunes and their fortunes on using misinformation to keep the, how did Donald Trump put it? I love the poorly educated. Well, this is how it was. So he goes, they're going to change my RNA, and I have a problem with this. He goes, and they're taking away our freedom and our liberty. Little by little, they're using the vaccine to cover. Last year, they took away our religious rights. They're not defending our freedom of speech, and this is just one way to take us to the next step. And I'm reading this, and I'm taking a look at the video, and I had the same kind of thing happen to me over the weekend. I was in a meeting with a bunch of folks who, way off the beaten path, and it came down to, you have these folks, these overly privileged, self-centered white, whiny baby boomers, and that's who most of this is, who have lived through the greatest moments in the history of civilization for working people. They have lived the charmed existence. They sit there with their defined benefit pensions, their Social Security, their Medicare that they're going to have till the day they die. They're driving up in their $80,000 and $100,000 pickup trucks, complaining about how hard life is and how they're losing their freedoms. And look, these are people who barely got out of eighth grade. These are folks with barely an eighth grade education. And now they're all virologists and epidemiologists. And, they're all the, because they watched a YouTube video and they saw it on Facebook. My grandfather always said, believe half of what you see and nothing of what you hear. And I'm of the mindset, and nothing ever on Facebook. In fact, you should immediately, if it's on Facebook, believe the opposite is true. But I'll tell you, it's amazing how many people say, I saw a video on Facebook. I saw something on YouTube. Oh, someone sent me. You should see. I have seen it. And it's propaganda. It's nonsense. I look at this op-ed, and the smart people are trying to break through. A doctor wrote an op-ed at the San Francisco Chronicle that I thought was brilliant. He says, as a doctor, I don't hate the unvaccinated, but I rage at COVID misinformation profiteers. And you know what? That's where I'm at. I feel sorry for some of these poor dupes. These people who, like I said, I know tons of them, barely got through the eighth grade, failed high school biology, but yet now, because someone said something that they posted on Facebook that they think is right, they now know something and they're going to regurgitate it at every opportunity. And because of their privilege, because of my white male, overly privileged, narcissistic, whiny baby boomer class is used to having their way, they feel emboldened to speak up. And that's what happened to me. I'm in this meeting and it's all these people who have had the best existence possible, better than any working person in the history of humanity. And they're whining about the loss of my freedoms. And then you ask them, well, what freedom are you talking about? Like this guy from Gainesville, they took our religious freedom. Really? They took away your ability to pray to your God? They took your ability away to believe in whatever it is, whatever snake venom you've bought into? They took that away from you? Oh, no. They said you can't fill up a church and have huge super spreader events? That's what you mean? You mean they wanted to protect you and others? That's taking away your religious rights? No, it's not. It's not. And again, it takes me to this place where I don't quite think you understand what persecution is. But we're in this spot where, and I go back to that Trump quote, love the poorly educated. Because as this doctor points out, some of the people run governments, Ron DeSantis, the former guy. Some have MDs next to their names. Others are millionaires. They have helped drive us back into the throes of this pandemic. He said, behind the millions of unvaccinated, there are those in power who have spread misinformation and cost countless lives. He says, I always keep the faces of the bad actors burned in my brain so as not to leak out any of my frustration on those often hapless and misinformed patients in front of me. And look, I give him credit for that. I do. Because, you know, my visceral reaction is, how could you possibly believe what you saw on an evangelical telecast at 3 o'clock in the morning selling you snake oil? How can you buy someone who's going, no, don't worry about what the entire medical establishment is saying is going to help us get through this. No, buy this horse dewormer. Or no, buy this stuff, this silver stuff that we really don't know what's in it. But hey, it does the trick. Throw the kitchen sink at it. Don't do the one thing that the entire medical establishment is saying this is the way forward. And again, I guess I'm fortunate that I have relationships with doctors that I trust. These are people who have spent their entire lives working to make sure that they understand what's going on. They've read the literature. They've seen patients. They've done all this stuff. They've spent their lives. They're dedicated to it. But I'm supposed to believe a guy who wrote a meme in his basement on Facebook. I'm literally struggling with this. There's no sane, rational way to go. And I've heard it. Dr. Malone said, never take the vaccine. No, that's not what Dr. Malone said at all. Dr. Malone said, and there's video of this, the most vulnerable people should get the vaccine first. They should get it. He still has the idea that, you know, we're only going to lose, you know, a small number of people if we don't vaccinate everybody. But he never said, don't take it under any circumstances. But my buddy in his PJs in the basement, typing away like the keyboard warrior that he is. I got a meme. It's going to get shares. It's going to get likes. Someone may actually give me money for this. He's out there trying to make a buck off of someone dying. And look, this is very serious. There are people literally dying from this. And yet, what we have is we have a system where you're not going to hold them accountable. And you end up having these folks who feel emboldened because now they're fighting against something. They're fighting for their religious liberty because someone told them that they can't cram 1,000 people into a 400-seat arena and infect each other because our healthcare system can't take it. Somehow that's an infringement on their religious liberty. And I think they should probably go back and read about true religious persecution. Because this ain't it. putting a cloth over your face so that you don't spread your spit all over everybody else is common courtesy. It's not an infringement on your religion. So when I see these videos and I see these stories of people who have taken some of the most ridiculous positions, all because they don't want to protect themselves, let alone anyone else, I get angry, I get frustrated. And I wish I had the ideas that this doctor has and say, look, you know, I don't blame these poor hapless souls in front of me. They're going to die, and they're dying a painful, horrible death, you know, holding on every last breath until finally they can't breathe anymore. And from what I've been told, it's a horrible death, one that nobody wants. And I don't think we've talked enough about what it is. But for him to go, look, you know, I'm looking at these people, you know, in media, these people in government, these people who are trying to make money off of this tragedy. I look at them as the reason. And I like that frame. Mentally, I wish I could get there, because I want to believe that we're all smart enough to filter through what is profiteering, what is just taking advantage of the poorly educated, what is about, you know, who can line their pockets with the most snake oil possible. That's why I don't sell beet juice. I don't sell any supplements. I don't sell any of that stuff, because those aren't the cures. The answer to this is protect yourself. Do the social distancing. Wear the piece of cloth over your face so you don't spread things. And if the other person's wearing one, they don't spread it back. It's the best defense we have. And then get the vaccine. Now, I've had a bunch of people tell me, well, you know, they can't make me. Yeah, they can't make you. They cannot physically hold you down and make you do it. But as I've said from the start of this, capitalism will figure this out. Corporate America is going to have to figure it out, because government can't. And we, the people, as representatives of our government, this whole idea of self-governance, evidently we're not smart enough or big boys and girls enough to actually go forth and do what needs to be done and do the right thing. We're going to continue down this path of being greedy, self-centered, narcissistic, whiny people who are proud to tell the world just how number one we are. All the while we're stepping in number two. How many of these baby boomers, and I blame them mostly, my cohorts, the people that I've spent years around, they will be happy to tell you, F your feelings. I don't care about you. And this whole mask thing, this is just the manifestation of that. This is them, in a very nonverbal way, telling you what they think of you. It doesn't come down to anything more difficult than that. These are people who it's all about them, and the heck with you, and the heck with your children, the heck with your family, and all of that. And it's put me in this position of anger, because that generation, as I said, had the best moments in the history of civilization, and they gave it away. Because of their arrogance, because of their greed, because of their self-centeredness. They had inherited from their parents a workforce that was overwhelmingly unionized, an economy that could support a family on one income, on stability and sanity. And what did we get out of them? What did we get out of the baby boomer generation? Greed. Hooray for me, the one who dies with the most toys wins. Greed is good. And they never get enough. It's never enough. They always want more and more and more. And who'd they get it from? Their children, who now are going to have to fight the exact same fights that their parents' generation had to fight because of them. And it's infuriating to me. I mean, I sat and I listened to people saying, well, you know, this younger generation, they don't want to do anything. They don't want to work in poverty conditions. They don't want to work 16-hour days. And they're organizing. I had one person tell me, well, you know, they need to get out and organize. Yeah. Well, what did you do? Well, that's right. You lived off the organizing of your parents' generation. That's right. You rode the roller coaster down the hill. And now that it's derailed, you're going to blame the people who are waiting in line to get on the roller coaster that is derailed. Instead of saying, hey, how as a country do we pull together and make sure our kids get the things that they need? How do we make sure that there's a future? Because here's the sad reality. If we continue to have the Ron DeSantis's of the world, if we continue to have the misinformation campaigns that we're seeing on all of these right-wing platforms, because it's about the money, it's about the clickbaits, it's about, hey, we're choosing our line in the sand because it's profitable, we're never getting out of this pandemic. It's going to continue to mutate. It's going to continue to get worse. And sadly, it's going to be the dim who die. It's going to be the weakest among us who die off. It's going to be people who had nothing to do with this. And for them, I feel sorry. For the guy in Alabama who they called 43 hospitals in three states to find an ICU bed for him, and they couldn't find it. For him and his family, I feel sorry for them. All because you have people so selfish and so self-centered, and I've had enough of it. This idea that, well, you know, they can't make me. Yes, they can. Capitalism will figure this out. You have choices. Choices have consequences. And those consequences are either you come to work and get vaccinated or you don't come to work. That's what's going to be the future. This is what the whiny, self-centered, greedy class has put us into. This is the end of the road. This is the final stage. And there's some who say, well, there's going to be revolution. Well, okay. If that's what it takes to put this virus down, maybe that's what it takes. But the truth be told, the ones who are the loudest, the ones who are, you know, puffing up their chest and spewing, the second you poke them in the chest and say no, is the second they shut up and sit down. And I'm of the mindset right now, we've got to be standing up and saying no more of this. You've had your wine fest, you've complained, you've done all that. It's time to be a big boy or girl, or it's time to suffer the consequences. This is a generation who complains, oh, we give away participation awards. Here's a generation that they didn't earn their self-esteem. It was given to them by the greatest generation. And they've always lived in that shadow. So it's time that we stand up to them. Just my thoughts. I'd love to hear yours, though. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Nothing more American than workers standing up.
Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day Rhode Island Governor Theodore Green demanded that federal troops be sent to crush a textile strike in his state. The general textile strike, then in its second week, stretched across the Piedmont from New England to Georgia. Green declared, quote, "We are face to face not with a textile strike, but with a communist uprising." His demands came after days of pitched battles between thousands of strikers and the Rhode Island National Guard in Salesville and Woonsocket. Secretary of War George Dern assured the governor and the press that 3,000 combat troops were ready and available for immediate duty in Rhode Island. President Franklin Roosevelt declined to send in federal troops, but the state assembly authorized the governor to close the mills and appropriated $100,000 in funds to beef up state police forces. The governor then directed Rhode Island's police chiefs to round up all communists on charges of inciting riots in textile centers across the state. It gave local authorities the pretext to round up and arrest over 200 alleged agitators, strike leaders, militants, and radicals. Over the course of 4 days, three strikers had been killed, including Charles Gorsinski at Salesville and Jude Cordomenci at Woonsocket. Hundreds had been seriously injured in the two cities. 7 of the 16 strikers who had been shot by state troops were near death. State National Guardsmen had been given the shoot-to-kill order to protect the mills and the scabs. Once the governor shut down the mills, police forces easily arrested dozens of flying squadron picketers and established martial law-like conditions, though it was never officially established. Within days, the strike would be quelled in Rhode Island. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Sad reality, what we've done in this country to higher ed educators. I don't even call them professors anymore because we've so badly broken higher education. But what we've done to these folks who are supposed to be teaching the next generation of highly educated folks is we've created basically highly educated, highly indebted sweatshops for workers who go into and really never get out of. They end up working for multiple universities, trying to cobble together a meager existence, let alone paying off the mountains of debt that they've been saddled with. And this is one of those moments where I'm thrilled to see finally people have said, you know, we're not doing it anymore. We're going to organize. We're going to fight. We're going to make conditions better. No more sweatshops in higher ed. And what we're seeing out in Western Pennsylvania, the University of Pittsburgh, right now there's a campaign, the campaign to organize them. The election's happening. I'm here to share some thoughts on that. I've asked Alex Press to come talk with us. Alex is a staff writer over at Jacobin Magazine. She's got a great piece out just on this titled "A Huge Unionization Vote is Looming at the University of Pittsburgh." Alex, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me as ever.
So this is a big deal. This is, what is it, like 3,500 adjunct professors and educators who have said, you know what, enough with the poverty wages, enough with the desperation, we want some rights.
Yeah, so it's something around 3,500, you know, give or take a few academics, and it's all ranks, right? So, you know, I think a lot of people think of professors as tenured professors, right? You think of like the cushy professor with the, you know, oak-lined office, all these great books, sort of living the dream in a certain way. But that is the minority of faculty across the country and certainly at Pitt. It's about 70% nationwide of faculty who are teaching in higher ed are actually adjuncts. So they have no route to being tenure track, right? And so they lack those protections and they also lack pay. So at the University of Pittsburgh, for example, I've spoken with adjuncts there who get, you know, maybe $3,000, $4,000 per class, and they're only allowed to teach two classes because they can't be teaching full time. Otherwise, the university gets into problems for keeping them as adjuncts. And so exactly as you said, Rick, you know, they're cobbling together from different universities. And again, we're talking about $6,000 or $7,000 a semester. That's terrible pay. You know, people really, I think people's understanding of what it is to be a professor in this country is maybe wildly misguided. And so, yes, at the University of Pittsburgh, they're including those low paid adjuncts. They're including faculty that are tenure track or are tenured now. So it's all ranks and it's across all schools except the School of Medicine for very complicated reasons. And so it's a huge vote, and it's being organized with an institution of Pittsburgh with a great history, a big history, the United Steelworkers. And so I think, you know, again, people who listen to your show probably know this, but these days when you think about a union, you know, the UAW as auto workers, that's not really who their membership is anymore. And so the steelworkers represent a lot of academic workers in Western Pennsylvania, which is where I'm based in Pittsburgh. And so this is not that unusual for them. They also have been organizing with the graduate students at Pitt. And so, yeah, as you said, this campaign has been going on for years, and currently they're doing mail-in balloting. So those ballots went out at the end of last month and they're due early October.
And we should get the results, you know, sometime in the middle of October. But, you know, as you pointed out, you know, like 70% are adjuncts. And you think of the University of Pittsburgh, which is a credible university. I mean, one of our esteemed universities in this country, you know, not some fly-by-night online place that advertises at 3 a.m. of how you can get a degree in 18 months. This is a legitimate, long-standing, reputable university who is abusing their workforce. And I would argue, if you don't have tenured track professors, if you don't have people who are part of the institution, I got to think that the education that you're paying for and that you're getting suffers.
Right. I mean, the phrase among many educators, whether it's public schools or higher education, is that the teacher's working conditions is the student's learning conditions, right? And it's totally true. I mean, it's common sense. If your professor is struggling to get by on their income, if she is leaving the class, you know, the minute that it's over to commute on the train or the subway or the bus to another university and then maybe to another job after that, you're just not going to be able to get that much attention from that person, right? It's not their fault, but they absolutely don't have the conditions that make for this ideal that you're paying a lot of money, right? To get that actual kind of incredible benefit that is being educated in a college setting. But these faculty can't do that, right? Because they're scrambling to get by. And the university, for its part, you know, you would think this would be almost in its interest to have, you know, not have these problems, you know, not have people who are completely unable to do, you know, right by their students. But instead, the university has fought this tooth and nail for years, hiring a union-busting law firm and stalling the process at the Pennsylvania Labor Relations Board. For a long time, by submitting inaccurate lists of who works there, that included dead people, for example, people long retired. So they have just been trying to slow this process down. And despite all their efforts, it's finally going forward.
Yeah, you know, and I look at this, and this is not new. This adjunct thing is something we've been talking about for years. And, you know, out in Western Pennsylvania, and the story always pops into my head whenever we talk about adjuncts, there was a woman, 83 years old, Vijoko, I think her name was, worked for Duquesne University. She was an adjunct for like 25 years. She couldn't get health insurance, basically died with unpaid, basically homeless because she couldn't get health insurance. She got no stability from her workplace, but worked for that university for decades.
Right. I mean, there's just no care at all. And people at Pitt have told me, for example, you know, one of the issues they have is that the adjuncts are hired semester by semester or sometimes year by year. Right. So if you have, say, a tenured professor who's leading research in public health and she has a 3-year contract for a research grant, the people she's collaborating with, her coworkers, other professors, might be hired year by year. So she has no idea if she's going to be able to keep doing this research the next year. And similarly, I mean, these adjuncts, there are adjuncts who've taught there for 20 years and still are hired on that incredibly short-term contract. So they have no stability, right? What if the university, for whatever reason it wants, decides not to give you the next semester's worth of work? All of a sudden, you maybe have raised an entire family in Pittsburgh. You've been there 20 years, right? And all of a sudden, you're just out of work and there's nowhere else to go. So it's incredibly unstable for everyone involved. And of course, the university is very hierarchical. It's very hard to get your issues addressed by anyone. You go to your department head, they have to go to their vice dean and on and on. And so a union actually makes that much more transparent and says, hey, here are some very practical problems. And so it seems very clear cut as far as why this makes sense. And certainly a lot of faculty across the country have agreed. There have been like 100 and something new bargaining units across the country in higher ed over the past 5 or 6 years. And so this one's a big one, but it's certainly, you know, part of a trend where faculty are seeing the writing on the wall and they're saying it's either going to get worse or we're going to do something about it.
No, and this is where I think the country's at in this moment. I mean, we just saw the recent polling coming out. Union approval ratings are at the highest they've been in 50 or 60 years. People are tired of, you know, working long hours for poverty wages. There's a want in this moment, and labor, for at least my view, is joining and forming unions is the way forward. It's the way to solve our inequality problems. It's the way to solve the kind of insecurity problems that we're seeing at Pitt and at other universities across the country. So I'm very hopeful for these workers that they come forth and win this vote. But as I understand, and I think you alluded to it a moment ago, the university is doing all of the union busting things that you would expect. They hired one of the biggest union busting firms in the state of Pennsylvania, Ballard Spa. They're doing everything they can do to take on the enemy, which is their workers.
Right. Yeah. So Ballard Spa has been leading these negotiations. So Pitt is a public institution. So this election doesn't happen through the NLRB, which maybe your listeners are more familiar with, but the State Labor Relations Board. And so that's where this sparring has been going on, where the university first files this list that is so much bigger than what the union, what the workers thought was their level of colleagues. It's so much bigger that actually they wouldn't have met the threshold for how many percentage of the workforce you need to have signed union cards to go forward with an election. And so they're very suspicious of this. They're like, you know, we did our due diligence. We're professors, after all, we know how to do research. And so something's up. And in fact, yes, it turns out that they included some undergrads in that list, some dead people, some people who've long retired, some people that clearly are management. And so it goes back again to the board, and it ends up taking a couple years to get to this moment. But the university is very clear on this, just as they were with the grad students, that this is not what they want. And this is part of university sort of rhetoric, right? They talk a lot about, you know, this is a free and open place. This is sort of this relic in our incredibly marketized society, right? Our precarious society. You still have freedoms here at the university, But in fact, those systems that they have in place that aren't unions are incredibly weak. So at Pitt, for example, you know, as with many universities, they talk about faculty self-governance, this idea that the faculty senate comes together and deliberates and sort of makes recommendations. But in fact, you know, I've spoken to adjuncts who said, yeah, we've been asking the faculty senate for years to give us better pay to ensure we have job stability, and nothing at all happens. And so clearly they've come to the conclusion that I think both of us hold, which is actually you need power in writing. And that's what a union is, right? You actually need to have a say at the table.
Yeah, without question. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Alex Press. Alex has got a new piece out on the University of Pitt election that's going on here with the Pennsylvania Labor Board. It's titled, A Huge Unionization Vote is Looming at the University of Pittsburgh, over at Jacobin Magazine. We'll make sure we get links out so folks can take a look at that. But, you know, I look at this, and again, it's a divide and conquer kind of situation. You've got the tenured faculty that they're okay, and there's only a handful of them really left, and they're clawing to hold on. While you've got all of these other people who are being exploited. And this is one of those moments where I go, if you're one of the tenured faculty folks, I think you want the adjuncts to have better benefits, better pay, the kind of things that you have, so that you're not alone in the shark tank. Or am I off base here?
Yeah, I mean, academia has a lot of stereotypes that are inaccurate, right? Of course, this sort of cartoonish idea of the extremely well-off tenured professor. But that said, I mean, it is a very hierarchical place, and it's certainly true that there are faculty that kind of, you know, they have what they want and that's theirs, right? Hopefully, we'll see with the vote. I mean, it's too early to say, but I've spoken to tenured faculty at Pitt who are on board with the union for exactly the reason you say. I think it's also worth mentioning for people who are listening, and I don't really go into this too much in the article, but there are efforts at the legislative level right now as well to actually mandate that any university or college that's receiving federal money have a mandate in place where 75% of the faculty have to be tenure track. So that would be massively changing the game, right? And I think it's an interesting illustration of how unions relate to that sort of legislative change, because it's been pushed by a bunch of higher ed unions, right? So Rutgers has a massive faculty union that's particularly sort of ahead of the average as far as thinking big and pushing for big changes. And they have kind of spearheaded that effort. And so it's currently being negotiated. Obviously, I would imagine it'll be negotiated down, because 75% tenure track would be so different than the current, which is, again, about one quarter to one third of faculty are on that track. But that said, you know, it's this interesting relation where a union like Pitt would sort of, you know, you form your union, also you can advocate for things like that, so you don't have to keep fighting every contract for something like that.
Yeah, and I got to be honest, if I'm Pitt, I think I want to have people who are attached to the university. I don't think I want someone teaching a class for the University of Pittsburgh and the University of Phoenix online, or one of these other for-profit colleges where the degrees are not the same, no matter what anyone says. I just think there's something different about someone like the University of Pitt, our esteemed universities across the country. I just see it as I think you want something better. I could be wrong, but that's where I'm at.
Sure. I mean, I wish that you were in charge of the business of running the University of Pittsburgh, because clearly the administrators don't agree. But I totally think you're right, that there's every reason that the community, that other faculty, and that the students themselves, their parents, should all be on board with this, because it does improve the university. It improves your teaching. It improves, you know, you want workers to stay there. You want them to be invested.
Now, we're at an interesting time. I mean, I had hoped we'd be in this moment back in 2010. I was hoping that labor would finally wake up and working people would say, hey, I've had enough of this. We want better wages, hours, conditions. But we're seeing a lot of organizing going on here. This is a huge thing. We're seeing it all across the country. We're seeing more workers going on strike than at any point that I can remember in my lifetime. And in fact, the John Deere workers, I guess, voted overwhelmingly, like 99%, to authorize a strike on Sunday. That could be a big strike. We're seeing others possibly going on. This is an important moment, I think.
Yeah, it's an important moment. And it's great. I write about labor for a living. I can't keep up with it anymore, which is not something that I could say even a couple years ago. You know, it's a comically and depressingly small world, it sometimes feels like. But now it doesn't feel that way, right? You can't keep track of the strike votes and the organizing votes. The Nabisco strike is still going on. despite a lack of, you know, discussion on, say, television about it. There are still thousands of workers on strike across the country at Nabisco, which is a massive corporation. And as you mentioned, John Deere, that would be in Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas, some 10,000 UAW members who, yeah, have overwhelmingly, with about 99%, voted in favor of authorizing a strike, should it come to that. And part of that, again, is that the company is proposing concessions, even as it makes bigger profits, right? So there's this interesting disjuncture. This was true with Nabisco as well, where these companies are making huge profits. It's not like they, I mean, not that it would even excuse it if they were in tough times to make the workers sacrifice, but these are companies that just, you know, are having paydays, and yet they haven't changed their understanding of where their workers are at. They think they can still push for concessions like worse health insurance with higher premiums, closing plants, you know, threatening to close plants, paying less in overtime premiums. But the workers are realizing where they are, right? They have more leverage in this moment. And that's why you're seeing all of these strikes. You're seeing people say, if there ever was a time to stop accepting these concessions, stop having our lives get worse, if we're not taking it now, we never will. Yep. And so I think a lot of people are putting things on the line.
Especially after coming out of this pandemic and you know, the realization that, and I think a lot of people that I've talked to realize that there are no benevolent corporations, that they're a negative on the balance sheet, and how easily they're able to be discarded. And I think people are now saying, no, I got to start looking out for my interest and that of my family. And it's about time. It's about time we see more of these actions go on. If we're going to close the inequality gap, this is where it's going to be. And I think it's important. Also, I understand there's the potential of striking carpenters soon.
Yeah, I believe that this week, actually, 11,000 carpenters in Washington state are set to strike. So unless something changes last minute, which sometimes does happen, that would be the biggest strike since 2019 when the Chicago Teachers Union went on strike. And I think it would be the largest strike in the building trades in some like 8 or 9 years. So it's definitely something people should pay attention to. It's, if it happens, it'll be one of those things that you'll be like, how did I not hear about it? So you're hearing about it right now. Again, people can't even keep up with all of this action that's happening at the workplace. But those are some highlights of what's going on right now.
And this is one of those moments where I always say, if you don't have a union in your workplace, we can help you get one. Because this is, you know, because I've had a bunch of people here recently tell me, well, the company's giving me this raise and they're giving us this and they're really nice to us right now. I go, no. Let's get that in writing so that they don't claw it back in a year from now.
Exactly. Yeah.
To me, it is that simple. But Alex, I appreciate the time that you've taken. I really appreciate the work you do. You do fabulous stuff. I hope folks will take a look at the piece over at Jacobin. We'll get links out. But thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Rick. Good talking to you.
Good stuff. Alex Press. Make sure you check out her piece on the election. A huge unionization vote is looming at the University of Pittsburgh. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day that the state police stormed Attica Correctional Facility in New York. 4 days earlier, the inmates had taken over the prison. One guard was killed. The guards were members of AFSCME Council 82. The prisoners demanded improvements to their brutal living conditions in the overcrowded prison. Police retook most of the prison, but the inmates held guards hostage in cell block D. One of the prisoners, Elliot James Barkley, explained the takeover. "We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not depend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disrespect for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States." When the police stormed the prison, they dropped tear gas from helicopters. They fired 3,000 rounds, firing on prisoners and hostages indiscriminately. They killed 29 inmates and 10 hostages. Police claimed the prisoners had killed the hostages. They also accused the inmates of committing atrocities against the guards. Public outrage swelled against the inmates, including racially charged hate directed at the black prisoners. But autopsies proved that all of those killed had been felled by police bullets. Attica became the rallying cry for those concerned about prison conditions. It has been referenced by many in movies and songs, including John Lennon's Attica State.
Attica State, Attica State, little old Bay State, Attica State.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, evidently, the Met Gala, all of really nice-looking people and really well-dressed, uncomfortable, what they're calling in America a lexicon of fashion to life. Lots of people showing up in really outlandish costumes. One of them being New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who showed up with a white dress with the words "Tax the Rich" in bright red. And I go, I love that. And good on her for doing that. Going into the belly of the beast where the wealthy and powerful are and going, yeah. Only if it would have said, eat the rich. If we could just eat one of them, and I wouldn't want to, but somebody should. Maybe then we would be able to have a reasonable tax code that they wouldn't fight against. And the reason I bring this up is you've got all of these senators now. You got Joe Manchin, you got John Tester now coming out saying, you know, we got to pay for it. We got to pay for that infrastructure. And there's a way to pay for it all. The Democrats and Biden have come out with a plan on how we can ensure that we get the revenue we need to invest in the things that we want. And, you know, Biden's original plan was to raise the corporate tax rate back up to 28%. It had been 35. The last administration dropped it all the way down to 21. And you go, well, numbers, my head's going to explode. They basically gave big corporations a huge tax break and allowed their tax avoidance attorneys a little bit more time to take that rate even lower. Because what we know is when it was 35%, when the top rate was 35%, the average U.S. corporation paid about 14%. So when they dropped that down to 21%, what do you think happened to everything else? Because they didn't take any of the loopholes. They didn't take away any of the tax dodges, any of the things that they used to avoid taxes. They didn't take that away. They just lowered the rate. And it hasn't done what they said it was going to do. Biden also wanted to raise the top marginal tax rate on the wealthy back up to 39.6. It is at 37. I mean, we're talking very meager number. And yet what you've got is, well, people balking at it. We can't possibly raise taxes on the rich, Rick. They're the smart people. They're the ones who create jobs. They know what to do. Yeah, they do. They know what to do. They make more money for themselves. This experiment of, hey, we need to create the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization because somehow it's going to trickle down on the rest of us and somehow it's going to be rivers of gold and honey and we're going to all be better off for it hasn't worked out. And I would argue we're in this moment. We're in this moment where, and look, I beat up on the baby boomers earlier, and rightly so, but in their defense, the America that they were told was their birthright has basically been pulled out from under them because we've created this massive weight around the working class known as our billionaires. We have a handful of people who are worth multiples of what society's worth. You know, when the top couple people are worth more than half of society, there's a problem. Houston, we have a problem. And yet we've got a country where more than 40 million people live below the poverty line, mostly children. And yet we say, we love the children. Got to make those women have them. But we're never going to take care of them. We're not going to fund education properly. We're not going to fund healthcare properly. We're not going to give people access to good paying jobs. No, no. You know, I talked to a kid today who was telling me that he got a job making $16 an hour. And that's an incredible job. It's the best job I've ever had. Going $16 an hour is literally, it's impossible to raise a family on. But some people are able to do it, and I don't know how. So for me, anything that we can do to undo the damage that our baby boomers have allowed to have happen is a step in the right direction. You know, when their parents, the greatest generation, roamed the earth, the top marginal tax rate in this country was 92%. They distrusted the wealth class. They knew which side they were on. But yet I listen to my baby boomer friends who they think that they're going to be the next Jeff Bezos. They got a little money in their 401k. They got a little money in their pension. They got a little money that they've squirreled away. Maybe they got $1 million. And they think, oh my gosh, I'm a millionaire. But $1 million isn't what it used to be. And we've got people who are multiples of billions paying a lower tax rate than the person who cleans up after them. There's something wrong with that. And the Democrats are saying, look, we need to take care of that. We need a more progressive tax code. And I like some of the things in the Democratic plan. I like the fact that we should have a progressive tax code where the more you make, the more you pay. It's like anything. The bigger your shoulders they are, the more you should be able to carry. Same thing with corporations. Small corporations should pay lower tax rates than bigger ones. That's common sense to me. And there's part of this that they're moving forth. According to the Democratic plan that was just released, the top corporate rate would apply to incomes over $5 million. The first $400,000 would be taxed at an 18% rate, not the 27% rate that they've put forth. Or 26.5. They're also going to throw some money into the IRS to go after our billionaires. And what we know the wealthy don't pay their taxes because we don't make them. We've done a really good job of defunding the IRS in areas that go after the very wealthy. And then we've gone after the poor people to make up for the difference. That needs to be undone. Because what we've found out and what the studies show is, according to the Treasury Department, we're leaving over $600 billion a year somewhere in someone's pocket, generally the people on our Forbes 400 list. And over a decade, just in tax cheating, we could have $7 trillion to invest. $7 trillion, which oddly enough is an interesting number because it's double the $3.5 trillion that we're talking about spending on human infrastructure, that we're talking about investing in our country and education and healthcare and things like that. Kind of makes you wonder, at what point do we want rich people who have all of this wealth and power, a guy like Jeff Bezos who can have a giant phallic thing fly him up almost into space and have a big giant bathtub boat that he can play with his dinghy on? Or do we want healthcare, education, preschool, school lunch programs, things that can bring children out of poverty, veterans out of homelessness, families out of homelessness? Which are our priorities? Because this is why elections matter. This is why elections have consequences. This is why we want to make sure that we have a responsive government. And I know that the popular theme amongst my baby boomer friends is that government's always bad. And how dare they make me wear one of those pieces of cloth against my face? Because we want smiles, not covered faces. It's my freedom to spew and spit all over you. I mean, think about how bizarre of a time we live in. When this is the one of the major political parties in this country's platform is, no, we don't need education for kids or health care for families or granny to get hearing aids or new chompers or any of that. We need a richer billionaire class. We need Jeff Bezos to have more tax breaks. We need more power in the hands of corporate interests. We don't need, you know, good jobs for working people. I mean, this is the twisted moment. There is a political party who's saying, no, don't protect yourself. Don't do the one thing that we know that can cut down on the spread of the virus, which is wearing that stupid mask, which I hate. Hate it. But I know if two people are standing talking at each other, the spit that goes at each other, we're cutting that down. Now, I had someone tell me, but, you know, Rick, it's aerosolized. Yeah, and you would literally need to be sitting on top of each other, making out. to be able to transfer that back and forth. Nothing is ever perfect. There is no absolutes. And this is the thing that my anti-vax friends, you know, they throw out. Well, there's no absolutes. You're right, there's not. There's no 100%. There's best case scenario. And what we know is the vaccine works. We know people who are vaccinated die at a lower rate. And look, in this moment, I'm thrilled by the fact that they're willing, that fewer people are dying, especially the vaccinated. But there's going to be a moment soon. And as the doctor I talked about at the beginning points out, there's going to be a moment where that's no longer going to be the case. And the numbers are going to continue to go back up. And then what do we do? Because we're never going to go back to another shutdown scenario. We're way too childish for that. We're not a society that's willing to do that. In fact, I'm actually shocked we did as well as we did the first time around. And I think that had only to do with the fact that Donald Trump was in the White House when it happened. Had Joe Biden been in the White House at the moment when we locked down like that, there would have been the revolution that the Trump supporters want. But because it was Trump, they were like, oh, okay. You know, for the most part, we're okay with it. We'll just go beat up on those Democrats because it's now the Democrats' fault, not the person who's in charge of the country, which is just twisted and bizarre. Same thing with what's going on in Afghanistan. I mean, it's twisted and bizarre that you've got Trump, you know, blaming Biden for what happened when it was Trump's policies that put him in that situation. But facts don't matter because we have people who live in their own bubbles. They live in their own alternative realities. And facts be damned, reality be damned. I still know people who think the virus is a hoax and will proudly tell you that. And we see stories of this all the time, that someone's on their deathbed going, oh, because it's not a hoax. Should have got the vaccine. And those cautionary tales don't seem to be quite enough for these folks. So we're in an interesting time. We're in an interesting moment, and it's something that we had better figure out how to work on and do quickly. Because our economy's struggling. We need massive investment. And you've got people like Manchin and Tester who now are talking about the debt, which only usually comes around when a Democrat is in the White House. You never heard any talk of debt and deficit during the Trump years, even though every year he spent in excess of $1 trillion, even above and beyond any pandemic money. It was never a concern. And now we're heading into another moment where we're bumping up against the debt ceiling, where there's talk of, what? We're not going to pay our bills? And yeah, that's what Republicans are going to do again. This is deja vu all over again. They'll try and hold the country hostage over the debt ceiling, which in the old days was, as one of my friends who was a former congressman says, it was a yawn vote. Because we already spent the money. It's just a matter of paying the bills. We've become that country. And the rest of the world is watching and concerned. Because from the outside, and some of the people that I've talked to who've you know, shared their insight with me of what they believe is going on here from the outside, is frightening. Because our political system is overrun by people who all they want is the next headline. All they want is the next tweet to get 1,000 retweets. All they want is to bring in the next campaign contribution. All they want to do is increase their star in their narrowly defined world. And we're running into this moment where people, corporations, people, entertainers, you know, Jim Brewer just recently came out and said he's not going to play in front of any crowd that has to be vaccinated. And I go, good. I never wanted to see Jim Brewer anyway, but good for you. But you're going to have these people who they're going to stake their fortunes, just like they did with the religious nuts. They're going to pursue that crowd. And that's how divided we've become as a country. Something like religion that should be pulling us together. Something like a religion that should be making us aspire to be better human beings, to live more virtuous lives, to be lead more moral lives, is now being used as the drum for war. is now being used as a drum for killing your neighbor, for committing all the sins that they claim they believe in those 10 rules that they want plastered everywhere, yet seem to never know what those 10 rules are. You know, I have this little test for anyone who says, we should be putting the 10 commandments everywhere. I always ask them, can you tell me what they are? And invariably, they can't. So is it that they need to be constantly reminded to be a decent human being? Or is this just a convenient talking point to shove their narrow-minded views down my throat? Probably both. No one's taking your religious freedoms. You have the right to worship whomever you want. And if you're like my one friend who goes to one of those snake venom churches where they reach into the box and pick up the rattlesnakes, even though they know it could bite them, and they could end up in the hospital, and all kinds of horrible things can happen, and doctors and nurses will take care of them when they need to, that's their right. And I'm okay with it, because it's their freedom. But the second they say that all the rest of us have to stick our hand in the box too, now we got problems. And this is the world that we're in. You've got people who have an alternative view of what life is and what it should be. And then the rest of us who are just trying to make it through the day. Trying to stay safe. Trying to keep our kids safe. There's a movement, a moneyed, funded movement, to take advantage of the anger over the masks that some parents who, you know, there are some parents I thought were sane and lucid who are completely off the deep end. I want to see my child's beautiful smile. Well, do you want to see that smile in a casket? And that's not, I'm not being hyperbolic. That can happen. The odds of it are very slim, but it can happen. But there's money out there funding this movement, organizing people to go to school boards and terrorize board members, organizing things politically to take over school boards, because eventually the goal is to destroy public education. That's always the goal. So that they can take advantage of Education Incorporated. They can get their noses into the trough of government money. That's the goal. And it's one of the things that I give the right wing credit for. They understand that you never let a good crisis go to waste. Sadly, that's where we are. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Back after this.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2013. Riot police used tear gas and water cannons to clear out Zocalo Square in Mexico City. The square was occupied by protesting teachers. The teachers had been on strike for weeks. They wanted changes made to educational reforms that had been passed by the Mexican government. The education reforms included new performance-related testing for teachers. But the reforms did little to address the economic disparity faced by many school children. The evaluation tests did not take into account the difficult conditions for teachers in the poorest regions of Mexico. The teachers worried the tests would lead to mass layoffs. Police wanted to clear Zocalo Square before Mexico's annual independence celebration. Most protesters left peacefully. However, some remained. Police, using armored vehicles and helicopters, clashed with the remaining protesters. Officers tore down protesters' temporary shelters and put out small bonfires. Protesters responded by throwing projectiles at the police. The police arrested many of the remaining protesting teachers. After the square was cleared, a BBC reporter noted that police had achieved their goal. Still, the reporter added, the sight of riot police and armored vehicles in the country's most emblematic plaza is not the image of unity the government wanted to portray hours before President Peña Nieto celebrated his first Independence Day as Mexico's president. If it sounds familiar, it is, because teachers in the United States are dealing with similar issues. Teachers, through their unions, in both the United States and Mexico, fight for a quality education for all children.
We don't need no education.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.